Report from Verde Gallery, currently showing Vision to Verse, Verse to Vision, a visual and poetic dialogue, paintings by Jessica Damon and poetry by Maje Regain. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom featuring hundreds of unique magazines at 17 East Taylor in downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, how would you answer this question? Are human beings naturally deceptive? Well, here's an observation on lying from Mark Twain. Lying is universal. We all do it. We all must do it. Well, today we feature a discussion about deceit, lying, and falsehoods with philosopher and evolutionary psychologist David Livingstone Smith. He is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. The book contains many fascinating observations on lying, including commentary on deception from Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain. Our guest, David Smith, agrees with Twain. Smith says deceit is essential to our humanity. He calls it the Cinderella of human nature, essential to our humanity, but disowned by its perpetrators at every turn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about lies and lying for David Livingstone Smith. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. David Livingstone Smith is currently a professor of philosophy and co-founder and director of the Institute for Cognitive Science and Evolutionary Psychology at the University of New England. He has published widely in the areas of deception and self-deception. His book, Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, is published by St. Martin's Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Smith, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm delighted to be here.
As I noted in my introduction, you say deceit is essential to our humanity. So, what if we were suddenly to shed all the little and big deceptions of our lives? What would happen?
Well, society as we know it would fall apart. Can you imagine going into work or meeting your acquaintances and so on and having them be fully aware of all of the things you think of them? Or indeed, can you imagine being exposed to the truth of what everyone that you know actually thinks of you, and which they normally cover through polite deception?
We'd never get out of bed.
It would be horrible. And this has been dramatized, for instance, in the film Liar, Liar, in which a lawyer is condemned to be honest for 24 agonizing hours and creates chaos in the process. Or works like Dostoevsky's The Prince, in which one of the lead character, Prince Mishkin, has this Christ-like honesty, which brings devastation in its wake.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We were talking here at the radio station about fictional lying characters, and actually there was a film made about a real con artist, and we found ourselves sitting in that film and cheering this fellow on, at least through part of the film, and that's the film Catch Me If You Can.
Yes.
So on one hand, we kind of fear being deceived. On the other hand, we can celebrate it.
Well, yes, we can celebrate it because, presumably because we in that instance, we identify with the character. You see, none of us likes to be deceived, at least when it's contrary to our own interests. We are less sensitive to deceiving others and our propensity to deceive others.
Hmm. In the first chapter of the book, Natural Born Liars, you say, according to the folklore of deception, ordinary decent people lie only occasionally and inconsequentially, except in extreme morally defensible circumstances. What kind of response do you get when you talk to people about lying? How do they feel about your theories on lying?
Well, one of the responses that I get is that people confuse what I say with advocating dishonesty.
Hmm.
I'm not advocating a policy of dishonesty. What I'm trying to do is to explain and to describe human beings' propensity for dishonesty.
And we have a great propensity for it. I mean, my husband and I were talking about this last evening, and, you know, we thought that if every time there was a lie or a deception in conversation and an air horn went off, the world would be a very noisy place.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, now, one of the things to appreciate in all of this is that explicit verbal deception, you know, the sorts of phenomena that we normally label as lies, is really only the tip of the iceberg. Deception is actually more prevalent, I think, in what, say, we don't say, or the little spin that we put on what we say, or indeed the way we behave, the way we present ourselves, our bearing. So I use lying or to really synonymously with the broader term deception.
Hmm.
And when we look at the all-encompassing nature of the propensity for deception, you know, it really becomes very pervasive indeed.
Yeah. How do you define a lie, then?
Well, a lie is any behavior that the function of which is to misrepresent. Now, that would extend from what we say when we tell an untruth to the way we dress.
Mm-hmm.
We want to call attention to a physical asset and away from a physical deficit, say. It would extend to hair pieces, cosmetic, manipulation of our faces, breast implants, all sorts of things.
Yeah. In the world of spoken communication, psychologist at the University of Massachusetts, Robert Feldman, suggests that there are three lies for every 10 minutes of conversation.
Yes, yes. And these are actually, his subjects identified three lies for every 10 minutes of conversation. And this is the lie in the very narrowest sense of the word.
Yeah.
And I think if you account for the lies that they didn't identify, and the lies that exceed that really narrow definition, for instance, failures to speak the truth, then you would find an even higher rate than that.
Yeah. Now, other organisms deceive. Mother Nature has come up with some glorious disguises. Animals protecting young will draw predators away from their young in order to protect them. What are a couple of the most wondrous deceptions you've come across in the non-human world?
Well, let me say something more broadly about that first, and then I'll give you an example or two. This is really very important. We are not alone as deceivers. Deception is really very characteristic of communication amongst non-human species. You know, right from the most primitive organisms, you know, the viruses, up to our closest relatives, the great apes, we find deception in many, many forms pervading the natural world. Now, the reason that is the case is because deception works. The ability to deceive effectively enhances the success of those organisms capable of doing it. And that's why we, as sophisticated primates, also have this tendency and tremendous talent for deception. Now, if we look at non-human species, my very favorite example, or one of my very favorite examples, is actually a plant, which is the mirror orchid, which is a member of a group of orchids called bee orchids that live in the Mediterranean region. Now, the mirror orchid produces a flower which mimics the female of the wasp that pollinates it. And it mimics the female very precisely, even down to her sexual scent, the pheromones that are produced by the female wasp. So when the male wasp flies over and spots this flower, what it does, it descends and attempts to mate with it. Now, the wasp is manipulated very, very precisely by the form of the flower, by its smell, even by the hairs growing on the flower, which mimic the hairs on the abdomen of the female wasp. The only thing that's absent in this setup, which you could imagine is really the flower-producing wasp pornography to manipulate the wasp's sexual urges, are the precise stimuli which would lead the wasp to ejaculate. So the wasp hangs around in this flower, really berserk with frustration. It bites the flower in frustration. This only releases more of the scent which is attracting it in the first place. And eventually, after a long entanglement, flies off laden with pollen, only to land on the next flower of the same species and cross-pollinate the plants.
Mm-hmm. So here we're getting a sense now, I think, a better sense perhaps, of what you mean by evolutionary roots of deception.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Talk with us about that, and about this theory of deception and survival, and how you came to this theory, and maybe you would talk with us about what others think of this theory.
Well, there's not a whole lot of... I've done a couple of things in the book in Why We Lie. One thing that I've done is I have presented what's become the standard evolutionary theory of deception and self-deception, which is something we haven't had a chance mm-hmm. to talk about yet, in a sort of a broadly accessible way. So up until this point, this literature has mainly been confined to relatively specialist literatures. And really, in terms of the biological dimension, it's really the only game in town. I mean, the way that biological thinking works is that we evolve characteristics because they enhance our reproductive success. In other words, those characteristics which lead us to produce more offspring or let our ancestors produce more offspring are retained. And those that they're competing against tend to go out of business. And of course, any biologist would approach the propensity of deception like this. In recent decades, it's been realized more and more and more how significant deception is in understanding non-human species. So really, all of that I've done is to take this literature and apply it to ourselves.
Hmm. When do you suppose humans began lying in speech, as soon as we had speech?
I would imagine so. I mean, the tendency for deception would already have been there. Speech gave us an immensely powerful tool, both for truth-telling and for mistruth-telling. And the reason for that is that speech lets us portray things which aren't there. So I can paint a picture for you. For instance, right now I could make up all sorts of things about myself at very little cost. It's not like other sorts of activities which require effort and just on the very basic level, the expenditure of calories. I mean, speech only requires intellect and the movements of my mouth and vocal cords. So we recognize this in everyday life. We say words are cheap. It's the very cheapness of words which makes them an ideal medium for deception.
Put your money where your mouth is.
That's right. Put your money where your mouth is, or actions speak louder than words. Actions are signs of commitment because they're more costly than mere words.
Mm. And language, the evolution of language, why do you suppose we needed language?
Well, there are a number of views about this. The view that I find most compelling, and which has a good amount of research behind it, oddly enough, is the view promulgated by a man named Robin Dunbar, and which is consistent with a lot of work done in the study of non-human primates. And the idea is this: in any social species, any halfway intelligent social species anyway, living in a reasonably large group, it is extremely important to network. And the reason it's important to network and to form alliances is because alliances and networking affect one's position in the group, can protect one from being harassed, and so on and so forth. Now, our nearest relatives, the chimpanzees and other non-human primates, accomplish this by grooming. Grooming is this wonderful practice where a couple of apes will sit together and one gently picks through the other's fur, removing bits of litter, using their fingers or their mouth. It's like a massage. And the recipient of grooming finds it extremely pleasurable.
Mm.
Now, what grooming does is it seals social relations amongst primates. Primates have grooming cliques, a few animals that will groom one another. If one of these animals is in trouble and gives a call of distress, it is likely to be helped by other members of its grooming clique. Now, if you think about it, grooming, because it's one-to-one and because it's really time-intensive, can only happen with a few members of a group, right? You couldn't groom, say, have as regular grooming partners, say, 20 other individuals, because it would take too much time, and you wouldn't have time for activities like finding food or mating or all the other vital things outside of the sealing of social relationships. Somewhere in prehistory, prehistoric human groups got large. And as they got large, grooming was insufficient to produce these kinds of social alliances that would protect individuals from harassment in the group and would give them a good network of allies. It's believed by many that language evolved in response to this situation. So language evolved as a kind of a social glue, as a way of servicing alliances with others. Now, the beauty of language, one is you can do it with your hands full. It's not so physically intensive. You know, if you're grooming, you really have to be occupied with the other person physically. But if you're talking, you don't. You could be out collecting food and speaking to your neighbor. Now, holding a baby in one hand, grabbing fruit with the other, and socially networking with language. It also allows you to connect with more people than would otherwise be possible. So you can verbally groom a number of people at the same time, rather than in a serial manner, which you're restricted to if you're doing chimpanzee-style grooming. So in short, the idea is that language evolved as a social glue. It didn't evolve as a way of saying, you know, there's a water buffalo down by the by the river, let's go kill it. It's kind of a caricature of the older view.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting thinking about this. When we are children and we discover the delight of having a secret that we can whisper to a playmate, we are doing some social grooming there. We're getting very close, and this is in the process of learning the power of language and the importance of friends or allies.
Yes.
And so, you know, we have to come close to one another, and then there's the whisper, and then later we learn. We take that in and move that out to, I have important information to share with you today.
Absolutely, this is gossip.
Yeah.
And that elaborate account I gave you a little while ago could be neatly summed up in the statement, we evolved language for gossiping.
Hmm.
Gossiping is the way we create these special relationships with others by exchanging valuable social currency. And it's also the medium in which reputations are built and destroyed in communities. So the gossip network is extremely important for understanding human relationships, as all of us knows. I mean, the way that, say, our members of our community speak about us to one another, the ways in which people in our workplace speak about us is crucial to our standing in our workplace or in our community.
Mm. David Livingstone Smith is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join us with your questions and comments. Give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. David Smith is currently a professor of philosophy and co-founder and director of the Institute for Cognitive Science and Evolutionary Psychology at the University of New England. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So how do we learn to lie? How are we taught to lie?
Well, the sense in which we don't need to learn. We need to, in the course of our development, there comes a point when our brains are wired up sufficiently to tell verbal lies. We're built to deceive. What our education does, that is the education we receive largely in our family, is to teach us what sort of lies are socially acceptable and what sort of lies aren't. I mean, we tend to have this naive conception that we teach our children not to lie. That's really quite ridiculous. We teach our children to distinguish between socially acceptable and socially unacceptable forms of lying. We teach our children how not to get caught. We teach our children what not to say on one occasion and what to say on another. And we do this partially explicitly and partially by example.
And you want to give us some examples of that?
Well, sure. Let's give a very easy example. Child receives a Christmas present that they hate, right? But we instruct them to politely thank the giver for the gift. In other words, we're teaching them to tell a lie, the type of lie which will work to their advantage in social situations. By the same token, many parents tell out-and-out lies to their children, partially in an effort to manipulate their behavior. For instance, they tell them things like, on Christmas Eve, a fat guy with a red suit comes down the chimney to give gifts to good boys and girls. I mean, it's a bald-faced lie. And we do this quite a lot.
Mm.
But we don't represent to ourselves what we're doing. That is, it comes as a shock sometimes. You think to yourself, this is a lie. We deceive ourselves about our own lies in this instance, like we do in many other situations.
Yeah. But, lying and deception, we need it so that we have some comfort level in the world.
Well, that's part of it, and that's that's part of it. I think if you look a little bit more deeply than that, we need it because it helps us gain certain advantages in the social world, which in turn then gives us comfort. So there are certain things we don't like to admit to ourselves because they would upset us, but these are often the very things that if other people found out about it would work against us as well. So, you know, we are all wheeler dealers. We're geniuses at social game playing. And we need the capacity to deceive in order to be socially successful. If we don't have it, we are pariahs.
Hmm. Self-deception. Let's talk about that. This is very fascinating. There's a country music tune, "I'll Lie Myself to Sleep." What would you like to say about self-deception, conscious and unconscious?
Okay. Well, it's always unconscious. You can't consciously
right.
deceive yourself because you know what you're up to at the same time. So it's kind of self-undermining. It's been recognized for thousands of years that people deceive themselves. You can find references to it in writings by the ancient Greek philosophers, but it's often been a puzzle. How could this happen? How can you be both the perpetrator and the victim of deception? It seems rather paradoxical. In more recent times, since Darwin, another puzzle has presented itself. What use could self-deception have? It seems something that would be basically disadvantageous to deprive yourself of information about yourself would seem to work against your own advantage, and therefore it seems it's like something which couldn't possibly have been evolved by natural selection. Now, the main theory of how self-deception works, or rather why it works, why it's there, what its biological utility is this. It's clear from a whole lot of considerations, which I trace out in the book and which I've alluded to somewhat already, that deception is advantageous. That is, those individuals who are able to deceive others without being discovered, that's very important. In other words, to deceive others successfully, reap certain benefits. They get more research sources. They make a profit, as it were. One of the problems with deception is that when the capacity for intentional deception exists for any length of time in a species like ours, it becomes a pressure for the development of the capacity to see through deception. In other words, human beings have become good liars, but we've also become pretty good lie detectors. We scrutinize one another. Now, it's the fact that we know others may catch us out in our deceptions, which makes it rather difficult for us to lie well. It takes a great deal of discipline to make a good liar, because we tend to get nervous, and shuffle, and stumble, and stammer, and raise our voices, and so on and so forth. And that very nervousness about being discovered then tends to give us away. So there comes a point, or there came a point, when we became too socially intelligent for our own good. The idea here is that we're sort of like Pinocchio, you know, who, when he told a lie, his nose would grow. When we lie intentionally, our very nervousness and our unease, which is concerned with others detecting us, may cause us to inadvertently betray our dishonesty. Self-deception appears to be nature's answer to this. You see, if you can deceive yourself, if you can lie to yourself about your real agenda, if in fact, often when you're deceiving others, you don't consciously know it, then there's no cause for nervousness. Well, if there's no cause for nervousness, then you're less likely to be caught in your lie. Think of it this way. The person who believes their own lies, who has full conviction, is much more likely to convince others, to deceive others, than a person who disbelieves his or her own lies.
Mm. Do you think we'll become better at detecting deception?
Well, you know, give us a long, long time, and we probably will, because evolution works on a very, very long time scale. However, we'll probably also become better at deceiving as well.
Yeah. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Actually, now a couple of callers waiting to talk this afternoon with us. Our guest this afternoon, David Livingstone Smith, author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. We're going to go first to a listener on the toll-free line, line 4. Where are you calling from?
Chicago.
Okay, go ahead.
I just have a comment to make. There was a famous philosopher, I believe he said that not all truths are for all men, nor all times. Would you comment on that? Mm. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Not all truths are for all men or at all times. How can I comment on that? It's very nicely expressed and could be interpreted in a number of ways. I guess what I get out of this is, and this is something we really need to remind ourselves of, because it's desperately important in this day and age. We are not fundamentally truth-seeking creatures. Right? Our commitment to truth is not unqualified. And the specific truths that we gravitate towards or gravitate away from will indeed be will vary according to who we are, where we are, and the historical epoch in which we live, although I think that there are many of these things which are really quite universal and transcend these variations.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on the campus of the University of Illinois, line 1. Hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I'm very interested in reading your book, and I've been listening a great deal of interest, and I'd like for you to speak to the issue of moral development. I guess what I'm interested in is if we are by nature creatures who are deceptive, liars, gossipers at the drop of a hat for our own social gain, where does all of this fit in our notions of moral development? Why do we even bother if this is our nature? I'm also interested in the issue of intention and the intention of the deception, whether or not that fits into the writer's thinking in any way. Thank you.
Okay, well, moral development, you know, what counts is what, there are many different views on what the basis of morality is, and there's really no consensus about that. Some people see morality, and I guess I have these ideals that the more that we know about human nature, the more that we know about our very natural tendencies, can only add to our picture of moral development and our efforts at moral education. The biological take on deception, the view that I argue and why we lie, that it is so pervasive and so built into us, really would lead us away from any simplistic injunctions to never lie. Right? In other words, this would be seen as an unachievable ideal. Right? And confronts us with the really formidable nature of the task of truthfulness. You know, it's not easy. It's something we have to work on constantly, and we have to help other people. Truthfulness doesn't come easily, and it's something we need to all help one another do. You know, a lot of moral injunctions, I think, might be looked at as really rather self-serving. That is, we very freely preach to others about goodness and honesty and so on and so forth. And of course, this is useful to us. None of us want to be the victims of deception, although we're all inclined to perpetrate it. And what often appears to be hypocrisy, I think, moral hypocrisy, is the obviousness of this situation. You know, the very people who preach these values in an effort to get others to be more truthful, which is advantageous for them, may, by the same token, freely deceive others. So I don't know if this has scratched the itch. You've opened up a very, very big area there in your question.
Yeah. Yesterday I read an email newsletter that is put out by a political camp, and there were two opinion pieces in this newsletter. One was decrying deception and are bent for for what the writer called situational ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And then you scroll down and hit on another opinion piece, and this was on a candidate's position on a particular issue. And the writer in this piece, and these are all partisans, you understand.
Of course.
They're in the same camp. But he was saying, look, if this guy says this and he gets some votes for it, well, then I'm all for this straw man.
Mm.
And so, you know, even within a relatively tight-knit group, you can have this what you refer to as, you know, this Cinderella story.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Although that the cynical advocating of deception is usually not very advantageous, for the simple reason that anyone who proposes that kind of position is obviously not trustworthy. You know, they're betraying their own deceptiveness. We've become surprisingly tolerant of such things now.
Huh. So, what do you think of the? You know, when we do think that, well, the writer who decried situational ethics. Mm-hmm. It depends on what situation you're in,
yeah,
how you should respond. And it,
well, all ethics, I think, are situational. You know, we can say even the person who believes that lying is always wrong would surely lie to save a loved one. You know, if a murderous psychopath comes to your door and says, I'm here to murder your child, is your child at home? You're going to say, no, my child's not at home. And if you don't, you would be considered a monster, even though you were telling the truth. So, you know, we can't abstract ethics meaningfully from the concrete situations encountered in human life. Now, there's a distance between that and a very loose set of standards about when it's permissible to cold-bloodedly lie.
Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. And it's also, this would also have applications in when to deceive in terms of keeping things secret, or
yeah,
trying to discover somebody else's secrets.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, and mm-hmm. It's worth repeating again and again and again. We do this all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every day of our lives, every day that we interact with others, be it our family, our workmates, our friends. We deceive, and they deceive us. Now, when it comes to public figures, I think it's incumbent upon all of us, and especially the media, actually, to exert intensive scrutiny. Right? We should, as much as possible, demand a very high level of honesty. Now, we can demand, of course, we won't get full honesty. That's, even if we do so, because our politicians are human beings. But it's part of their job to look after us. And it can have very, very terrible consequences if we're deceived. By the same token, now this is sort of an ideal, I think that we have, I don't think we're really consciously anyway, globally, that in concerned with our politicians being truthful. It's only in certain circumstances with respect to certain issues. Hmm. Indeed, any aspiring politician who attempted to be consistently truthful would have a wrecked career. There are certain kinds of lies which we crave and which our politicians deliver to us.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Chicago, line 4. Go ahead.
Thank you. We're talking about politicians. It reminds me of the fact that presidential libraries have sections that are closed to the general public and information for anywhere from 50 to 100 years because they want people to see what was really going on to reveal all the possible lies, deceptions, shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
And since you touched upon that so nicely, I look forward to reading your book. But I wanted to comment about the fact that there is an expression, I don't know you well enough to be able to tell you the truth.
Mm.
And meaning is the truth might shock a person, hurt a person, or spoil whatever is their particular philosophy.
Yes, 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 indeed.
So we have to be each other sometimes for these, whatever you want to call them, white lies or little fibs. And but going back one more further point in the religion, the Bible and certain other scriptures talk about speaking in parables, which some people may not have the conceptual ability to grasp and the vision to encompass all that's being related in that. And we're still going through interpretations of those matters. So not that they're meant to deceive, but they certainly weren't clear enough to say the gospel truth. And other scriptures have this predicament where, like in the current war situation, those that were advocating an interpretation of the Quran may have been deceived by their interpreters, too, to the point of we're in the situation we're in. So I thought I'd offer those points. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. On the whole, the biblical treatment of lying, by no means a biblical scholar, by the way, is less naive than the way we tend to look at it today. I mean, St. Paul says somewhere, we all lie. He's right. He said exactly the same thing as a very irreligious man, Mark Twain, said a couple thousand years later. Jesus gives a parable, I believe it's somewhere in Matthew. He has a parable of the two sons, one of whom is asked to do some work by his father and lies and says he will do it when in fact he doesn't. And the other son says he won't do it to his father, but then comes around and does it. Now the first son, if I remember correctly, is described as the good son. In the ancient Middle East, and indeed in the Middle East today, lying is seen as and acknowledged to be acceptable under certain circumstances. You don't, for instance, to go back to the parable I just described, you don't shame your father in public. I mean, it's perfectly acceptable, in fact, incumbent upon you to lie to preserve your father's dignity and honor. And if we go back, of course, to the Old Testament, is it the Eighth Commandment? It doesn't say thou shalt not lie. It says thou shalt not bear false witness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a kind of wisdom in these various biblical pronouncements. You know, it's a more accurate understanding of human nature expressed in them than perhaps is expressed in many of our taken for granted contemporary Western views.
Yeah. Well, one of the pieces of literature that springs to my mind in terms of when we think about lying is Heart of Darkness.
Mm.
Where at the end of the story, a lie is told, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It and all the horror that has preceded it suddenly is is put aside.
Yes.
In for the sake of a person's peace and dignity.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. This is, and again, I can only reiterate as I try repeatedly to explain in the book, although it's something that is often repugnant to us. We lie a lot every day, and a lot of that, those lies, we're not aware of because we're lying to ourselves about them. This is the human condition.
Mm. There we have to leave it. The time has flown by. David Smith, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It was delightful. Thank you.
David Livingstone Smith is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the corn pit mostly higher. The far deferred September was lower for the day, but everything else was higher. The beans were a bit lower on the day in the wheat pit. Finished the nearby contracts up, but the deferred's lower. In the wheat pit, September futures had high today at 313, their low at 307.5, and settled at 312. They were 2.5 higher on the day. December contract for the wheat, 326, the high, the low at 320.25. Settlement price there at 324.5, and they were up 1. March contract, 337, the high, the low at 332.5, a settlement price at 336, down 0.25. And the May contract, 341.5, the high, low at 338, a settlement price at 340.5, down 0.75. July futures in the wheat pit, 344, the high, the low at 340.5, a settlement price there at 342, down 0.75 cents. Hey, by the way, if you missed a couple of the Ag Outlook meetings, or they were just too darn far for you to drive this past week when we were down in Terre Haute, or last night when Dave Dickey was over at Williamsport in Indiana, there are three more chances next week here in the local Champaign County area. Now, a little bit farther out than that, but close enough. We'll talk on Farmer City on Tuesday night, Monday night, by the way, down at AgriGold outside of Tuscola. And then Thursday evening, Dave will be a little farther away than that. He'll be down in Newton. So he'll have a darn busy week next week. Hope that you get that opportunity to make one of those. Listen during this closing market report at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon. I'll give you more details on when, where, and how of those WILL Ag Outlooks. Now the corn pit for the day. September futures had a high this week in the corn, or today rather, at 231.5, a settlement price at 226.5, a settlement, or a low at 226.5, and a settlement there at 231.25, that for the September corn, and they finished 2 cents higher on the day. December contract now, 242 the high. Low at 237.25, settlement price at 241.75, they were up 1.5, and the March contract had a high of 250. Low at 245.75, settlement there 249.75, a penny and a quarter higher on the day. May futures 255.25, the high, the low 251.25, settled a quarter cent off the high at 255, and they finished 0.75 higher. July futures 259.75, the high, the low at 55.75, and settled up near the high at 259.5, down rather up 0.75 for the day. The September contract's the one that finished lower. It was off 0.25 cent at the end of the day at 260.25, with a high of 261, and a low at 259. From the oat pit, the nearby September's 142, the high, the low at 138, a settlement price at 141.75. They were up 5 cents on the day. December futures 151.75, the high, the low at 146, settlement price at 147.25, 2.5 higher on the day. September futures from the bean pit now, 596, the high, the low at 589.5, settlement price there 594.75, 3.5 lower. November's 587.5 high, low at 579.5, and a settlement at 585. They're off 4.5 cents. January contract 594.5, the high, the low at 587. A settlement at 591.75, down 3.25 for the day. March soybeans 601, the high, the low at 593, settled 597.5. They were 5.75 lower. And the May 605 high, low at 599, settled 602.75, down 5.75. July soybeans 612, the high, the low at 604, settled 607 in the July. Down 4.5 cents for that bean contract. Bean meal now finished the day like this: 201.50, the high, the low at 198.60 in the September's, the low at $200 even. And they were off 70 cents on the day. October contract to 180.50 high, low at 176.40, settled at 176.60, down 380. September bean oil, 23.68. The high, the low at 22.94. Settled 23.55. They were up 39. And the October contract, 23.15. The high, the low at 23.57. A settlement price at 23.02. For the bean oil, they were up 29 cents. In just a moment, Celeste Quinn will be here with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Don't forget, Peter Cattle, Cattle and Feed report is due out very shortly, and we'll talk about that at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon, when we talk with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities in near West Lafayette, Indiana, in Chalmers today. Now, here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. August feeder cattle, the high price today, 118.25, the low 117.80, the settlement 118.17.5, that up 45. September 115 even, the high 114.30, the low 114.77.5, the settlement, that up 42.5. October 113.40, the high 112.80, the low 113.12.5, the settlement, that down a nickel. August live cattle 85.45, the high 84.90, the low 85.02.5, the settlement, that down 37.5. October live cattle 86.80, the high 86.17.5, the low 86.27.5, the settlement, that down 27.5. October lean hog 66.20, the high 65.45, the low 65.77.5, the settlement, that up 45. December 62.87.5, the high 62.10, the low 62.80, the settlement, that up 72.5. February 62.20, the high 61.15, the low 62.10, the settlement, that up 102.5. And April lean hog 60.75, the high 60.15, the low 60.75, the settlement, that finishing up 52.5. And August pork bellies 89.27.5, the high 86.05, the low, finishing at today's high 89.27.5. That up the limit of $3. The Dow up 65 points at 10,106. The NASDAQ 18 higher at 1838. And the S&P 500 up 7 points at 1098.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Arthur Edward Rohrabach III from Chatham, New York writes, Dear Dr. Science,